name is David Lowry. I'm the director of Angels and Bodies Saints, and you're listening to Adjust Your Tracking.
Hello and welcome to Adjust Your Tracking. Sitting next to me is Joe Von Oppen.
And next to me is Eric McClanahan.
The voice you heard previous to this was director David Lowry. You can hear the rest of that interview after our review of his film, Ain't Them Body Saints.
Ain't Them Body Saints?
Dear Ruth, I dreamed about you again last night. I hold your face in my mind. I think about your hair getting longer. I think about your belly getting bigger. I think about our baby girl.
I shot someone. I think I shot someone.
It's gonna be okay. All you gotta do is wait for him.
I'm confused, Ruth. I don't know why you kids did what you did. What do you want to do now?
I'm gonna wait for him.
It's gonna be all over the news later. Thought best you hear this from a friend.
Hear what?
I know you know I'm out, and I hope you know I'm coming for you. Just like I always said.
I'll put an end to all this right now, all by myself. All I'd have to do is tell the truth.
Whatever it is you've done, when I see you with your daughter, all I see is good.
Maybe I'm just fooling you.
People talk about regret. But I haven't got any. I traveled high and far, and now I'm close. I'm so close to you, I can almost reach out and touch your cheek.
You take those girls, you got trouble.
Maybe you get out of town till all this blows over.
You mean till he gets caught?
Have you seen him?
Sure haven't.
We can make it. We can make it if we run.
Every day I wake up thinking today's the day I'm gonna see you. And one of those days, it will be so. And then we can ride off to somewhere. Somewhere far away.
So Joe, this film opens this week, this Friday, at Portland Cinema 21. It is the only theater it's going to be at, I believe.
Do we know if it's a print or not?
It is DCP.
Okay.
So right. That's a shame because I think we can lead things off with how freaking beautiful this film is.
Yeah, I feel like you told, like, every time you say DCP, it's just a hand on my shoulder. Like, it's DCP.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I mean, that doesn't look bad. It doesn't. It is a beautiful film.
Yeah, indeed it is. I mean, visually and in a lot of other ways, emotionally. This film, to me, seems right up our alley. I thought it was when I heard about it at Sundance this year. It did really well. Got a lot of great reviews out of Sundance this year. And director David Lowery was also sort of seen as a really talented multi-hyphenate because he's an editor, mostly. That's what he normally does.
He edited Upstream Color.
He edited
Computer
Upstream Color.
Chess, also from Sundance.
Bujalski film or whatever, which that looks kind of awesome, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder when we'll get that. But
it's sort of, I think it's making the rounds because it got a lot of buzz, but I think it's a different kind of buzz for a smaller, more unique pigeonholed type of movie.
It's that relative buzz. Like, it's got buzz compared to, I guess, other small, very niche movies. But it does look great. There's a pretty interesting trailer out there for Computer Chess. So yeah, he edited that.
Okay.
I think I've already talked about it. The editing in Upstream Color to me is just amazing. Actually, I love that film so much, but I think the editing is the thing that blows my mind every time I watch it.
Yeah.
So he's clearly a talented guy.
Yeah. This is something that, like, he, as an editor, has all, like, different types of, like, rhythms with his editing. Like, Upstream Color has a very specific kind of rhythm. And with Anthem Body Saints, it has, like, there's definitely a more lyrical, poetic quality to it. That's, like, it's the pace is a little more languid. Not without its urgency, but it, like...
Definitely.
He definitely shows that, like, he's a master of different types of rhythm.
Yeah, and there were moments, just an occasional moment here and there in Anthem Body Saints where I saw him kind of using those match cuts that he used so effectively with Upstream Color, where he could kind of piece disparate moments into one scene. And it's just so well done in something like Upstream Color. But here he only does that a few times, and I think it was really effective in that sense. But yeah, usually most of this film is a very, you know, it's patient. It takes its time. It's ultimately a really, it's a really interesting movie in terms of its genre. And I think where it starts is where most of these kind of movies end. And the kind of movie I'd say it is, I guess, what do you want to call it? Like a Bonnie and Clyde type, a Badlands type of, you know, criminals, lovers on the run type of movie.
And I think when we initially talked about it, when it was, had just played at Sundance, we kind of had an assumption of where, like, it was more drastic in terms of, like, it starting where other movies stop.
Right.
But, like, I mean, we just assumed the movie was going to take place in jail or something like that. But it does have, like, an ongoing story that makes sense. And it does share, like, a weird kinship with The Place Beyond the Pines, kind of, in that sense of, like, taking ending points and using them as a jump off.
Exactly. And it's... I think just that story we're getting at in this film is about Casey Affleck is your lead actor along with Rooney Mara. They're in love. The opening scene is just them walking through a field. They're having a fight. And from there, we see the beginning of a crime they're about to commit. And then after that, it's a gunfight, almost kind of thrown in the middle of a gunfight. That reminded me in some ways of The Proposition, the way that movie just opens on a... that's the very opening scene of that film, but...
there's no exploding Aborigine, you know?
There is no exploding Aborigine head or spears through Guy Pearce's body in this film. But the gunfight happens, and one of their crew is killed, and then Casey Affleck is captured. He basically gives himself up because Rooney Mara has shot a police officer, and he figures it's better if I just give myself up and you get to go away, because she's found out she's pregnant at this point. So from there, and honestly, most of these movies do end with either the characters being arrested, but more often than not, they're killed at the end of the movie. Here, okay, Casey Affleck is arrested, and that's where the jumping off point for this film is, because it's about them two, Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck, just longing, trying to get back together. Why are you giggling?
Because them too. Like, it's just like the title has started like a rustic kind of infection going on.
That's true. And I, you know,
them two, there's like an unrequited love.
And I ran out of time talking with David Lowery. I did not get to ask him what the title is about. But from what I understand, it's Casey Affleck said it on Conan or something, that it had to do with, he just thought it was the lyric to some old song that he was a fan of, and he turned out he was wrong. It was just a classic case of, like, he thought the lyrics were something else, and it was too late at that point, and he stuck with it. But it really is an evocative, twangy title, appropriately twangy for it's set in Texas. But there are a lot of interesting things where you got that title that seems so classic and perfect for the period. It's set in the 70s in Texas. So right away you get another sort of touchstone with Badlands, at least when Badlands was made, not when Badlands was set.
Right.
But I think a very close approximation in terms of the film is something like Badlands, where it's a period piece about 20 or 30 years back from when it was made. But this one is not based on any true story. This is just sort of a, this is almost like a fairy tale in some ways, or a sort of told in a mythological way. One of the things I like the most about it is that it opens with, instead of once upon a time, it says, this was in Texas, I think, mm-hmm. dot, dot, dot. And I found that to be a refreshing, original way to kick off the story.
Interesting. You took issue with that in End of Watch, that sort of intro.
But they said once upon a time, and I just feel like that's... My issue is that couldn't they have come up with something else instead of... But I just felt like that was a little more lazy. You're right to call me on that. I took issue with that in End of Watch. But here, if they would have done Once Upon a Time, I would have made the same knock. But he kind of went for something a little different.
If we were in the theater, you would have went, ah.
He would have heard a little, ah.
And that opening scene right after the This Was in Texas, like there's such a great naturalism to their kind of playful back and forth, like
yes.
banter with each other. Because there's like, there's very, you know, sensible tension between
yes.
them. And then it, like he sort of disarms it with his high-pitched charm, that Casey Affleck.
That Casey Affleck,
even
yeah.
when he's punching women to death and the killer inside me, he's still charming.
Yeah,
but
creepy
like,
and charming, though. He's always managed
he's got
to,
a menace,
to have that.
Yeah,
he does,
for
he
sure.
does. Yeah, there's something off-putting about him sometimes.
Yeah, there's like a just a detectable menace, like, you know, even from his like early work with Gus Van Sant and To Die For, you know.
Oh, that's right, he's in that. Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think he steals the show in Good Will Hunting, too. Like,
yeah.
He's my favorite character in that movie.
Yeah, the humping the glove scene.
It's so good.
It's great. But yeah, there's like this something that was interesting to me was that like I think we talk about this a lot with like filmmakers who have become iconic. It's Malick, man, those type of like kind of untouchable filmmakers.
They get a pass.
Yeah. Who've become known for a certain type of work they've done that they aren't necessarily replicating anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like Terrence Malick's not gonna make another Badlands.
No. Nope.
And then along comes films that are like, well, if Terrence Malick isn't going to make Badlands, like maybe somebody else will.
Right.
And they sometimes are just like, are nothing more than stylistic exercises, like House of the Devil. I mean, I think that movie is expertly done, but it's a stylistic exercise.
True.
And this film feels like it could do that. Like, you guys miss Badlands?
Yeah.
You like that one, right? He's not going to do it anymore, so I'm going to do it. If it were just that would be fine too. But like, there are some really amazing dimensional characters in this film.
Agreed.
That like, you know, as the story develops, there becomes like a love triangle, and every part of that triangle is dynamic and heartbreaking and
yes.
just sort of tragic in its own way.
And complex. Like,
yeah.
It's never... David Lowery does the smart thing of, it's not like it's an easy choice for Rooney Mara that she's in this situation.
Right.
She's resistant to the whole idea. And we should say the third leg of that triangle is Ben Foster, who I have to admit, I've been kind of a hater on that
why
guy.
Is that?
I don't know. To me, this is really reductive, but in my mind, I've always thought he's just sort of a poor man's Ryan Gosling.
Okay.
Maybe because I've always tend to gravitated toward what Gosling does, and I see a similar edge to what Ben Foster wants to do. And admittedly, Ben Foster wants to work with good directors. That's clear. That's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And he tries things. He tries to be interesting.
Come on, Ben. You know that's Ryan's thing. Like, he wants to work with good directors.
It's not that. It's just that I feel like... I guess maybe I'm just liking the movies even more that
right.
Gosling is in than Ben Foster. But I have to admit, this movie has sold me on Ben Foster. I think he's... In a way, he steals this movie, but that's not even the right term because he underplays it to a perfect note. He underplays it, and he's the cop that actually happens to be shot. It's in the shoulder in the beginning of the film by Rooney Mara's character.
Mm-hmm.
But since she ends up, you know, raising their baby in a house while Casey Affleck is in jail, he sort of takes it upon himself. You can tell he's really interested in this woman.
Right.
And... Yeah, it's a complex, there's no easy way out for that situation, and there's no easy choice. It's not like he's a jerk and Casey Affleck is the guy she has to be with. It's like, well, you can kind of see why that would be a difficult situation she's in.
And the way it's demonstrated, like, through her, like, reactions and kind of underreactions are so clear.
Mm-hmm.
They're not over kind of indulged in. They're not over explained through really painful expository dialogue.
Exactly.
They just, it's like a look she gives, and like, I mean, she's amazing in this.
I can't think, she hasn't been in that many movies yet, but everything I've seen her in, I mean, even the brief moments in Social Network, she was amazing in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and she's really good in Soderbergh's Side Effects, which came out earlier this year. So I mean,
see it.
For her performance, it's worth watching, I'd say.
Yeah, and the kid, like,
oh
her,
man,
their daughter mm-hmm. in the film is amazing. Like, oftentimes, like, I'll find that, like, most European acting children are just much stronger, and there's like a self-awareness with like American kid actors that's grating and sort of hard to sit with. Like, that is not the case at all with this kid.
Right.
She's amazing and adorable and makes the, you know, like everything that's already sort of heart achy about this movie.
Yeah.
Even worse.
And I'm just thinking too.
In the best way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just realizing myself that they never use the kid as a cheap means for tension or suspense. The kid's never really in danger.
Or the kittens.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
There's kittens in the movie and there's a kid. And like, I was like, oh great. Now they're introducing kittens. Like, so they can drown them at some point. No, they don't.
This is truly a movie for Joe Von Oppen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I mean, Gene Siskel would approve that the kid is never, you know, unnecessarily put into danger in this movie. And just beyond all the things that this movie avoids doing that is so, you know, admirable, like the things we're just mentioning, it's that opening shot you talk about, that opening scene, like the way it establishes characters within a scene immediately, because it just feels like either they did a lot of rehearsal, but like you've got that chemistry immediately between Affleck and Rooney Mara.
Yeah.
And then all the characters are really, they're maybe working off of archetypes, but they're not creating archetypes. These are fully fleshed out human beings. And another actor that I just was so pleased to see on screen that I feel like perfectly cast was Keith Carradine in this.
Yeah.
And Keith Carradine is the father of their cohort that's killed in the beginning of the movie. So he holds a little bit of animosity between Casey Affleck at this point, and he has took it upon himself to look over the Rooney Mara character. Mm-hmm. And that also adds a really complex dynamic to this film where it's a 95 minute movie, but it's so packed full of it feels epic but not overlong. You know, it doesn't feel like it's overstuffed, but yet it's got all these things going on that really feed into a thrilling, by the end it sort of has you know, there are other movies we want to talk about that came out this year, that have come out this year, that are very similar to it.
There's an interesting, like, kind of American cinema preoccupation, which is not new, but it seems really concentrated this year with, like, The Outlaw,
you know?
And, like, the tragedy of The Outlaw, and, like, The Place Beyond the Pines, which we already mentioned. Like, there are mirror scenes, like, in this one, like, just involving, like, children and how like the children can be the kind of like the witness of this tragedy, you mm-hmm. know, and like, and how fragile that is. But like, it's this and Mud. Just seems like there's it's in the zeitgeist.
Mud as well took the majority of its runtime to build up the relationships and the characters.
Yeah.
And the tension would be peppered in there by the moments of genre being thrown in there. Like, there are bounty hunters after Mud in that movie, just like this movie too. And you're rewarded if you know, like those type of movies, you're rewarded with a sort of shootout or a thrilling aspect, a sort of genre action-y scene near the climax, which happens in Eighth Embodied Saints as well. And they're both so effective at getting you to care about all these people, as flawed as they are.
Right.
And a movie like this, Mud is one of my favorite movies of this year, and it totally affected me emotionally. So did Place Beyond the Pines. And this is the third one of like those very similar type of movies that I didn't expect to be this affected by a movie that is essentially just like an outlaw, a crime movie, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting that, like, you know, because these elements of genre that erupt into, like, an otherwise naturalistic film, like, in that type of genre, you'd just be waiting for those moments to happen. You'd be going through, like, the beats of the movie, being like, oh, okay, this is where he has to return home, this is the Dark Side of the Moon moment of the movie, as Octay pointed out at one point.
Yep, Octay, the script, you know, the
doctor.
Script. Yeah, he is always on point with that stuff.
So, like, you would just be waiting for those moments to happen, whereas, like, with this, you're pulled into the story, you're involved with the character, and the genre, like, elements blindside you. And you're like, oh no, like, I don't want this shootout to happen, whatever it is. I don't want them to be pursued, because you genuinely care.
Yeah.
You're not caring because, like, the music cues are telling you that you should have cared by now.
Yeah.
Like, you genuinely do care. Like, from the very first scene in this.
That's the thing. That opening scene is so effective because it has to establish their entire relationship in 5 minutes. And that's where I feel like the chemistry was there, and just the naturalism.
Less than that, I feel
it's a very brief scene. And then it's all done in, if I remember right, one pretty long take, handheld, but there's an intimacy to the usage of handheld. Like, everything seems so well thought out, instead of, like, we're a low-budget movie, it's just all handheld, you know, or some sort of arbitrary decision to do that because it looks cool. It gives you the intimacy, and it's sort of moving along with the two characters as they float around the field that they're talking about, you know, walk around. It's not a Malick movie in that sense. They're not floating.
Well, I wonder if, like, compare... I mean, of course it gets compared to Malick, you know, just sure. because, like, it does feel like it mirrors Badlands in a way. They eventually talk about possibly going to Montana, you know?
Yep.
Above the Badlands, and it's interesting, because that scene could have easily, like, you see where Malick attempts to capture that scene again with, like, the sort of wind-blown, like, tree limbs
and, golden
like,
stuff fields.
Like that. Yeah, like, and how that is just completely vacant now. Mm-hmm. Those scenes, like, they're not filled with a genuine chemistry between the characters.
In Malick's films.
Right. Yeah. It's just, like, people twirling, mm-hmm. wheels, like, fields blowing, and, like, just nothing happening. And you're just sort of like, what? Like, there's no consequence, and there's no sense of engagement.
It's a reminder that style that he really was a big part of making, you know...
Mastering.
Yeah, exactly. Can still be used so effectively if you get at the important stuff, like the characters, whatever it is that you want your film to be about. Whereas it just, I mean, not to harp on Malick too much more, but it seems like he doesn't always know what he's going for anymore.
Right.
And because he's reaching so much, it has the potential to be a real dud, like to the wonder.
He's going for the intangible. He's going for the things that cannot be put to words.
You're right, but that is...
That's such a cop-out.
Yeah, exactly. And when you can meld the beauty and the aesthetic, just the control and just the beautiful pictures that are here in this film in Ain't Them Body Saints, but with a story that's compelling and characters that you care about, you've got something that is reminiscent but of a Malick,
does its own thing
and also reminds me of other films, like, you know, Bonnie and Clyde. I already said it has elements of that. It's got Sugarland Express elements to it, mm-hmm. as well, the early Spielberg film. There's a whole bunch out there that are like this, but this one kind of carves out its own path. It's its own thing, which is remarkable, if you ask me. And
yeah.
If more movies, maybe we're just being spoiled this year, which is a shame, because that means we have a long time to wait before we get a crop of movies that'll be like this. But I just feel like this has been such a strong year because the way American filmmakers especially have focused on genre. I mean, not even in a different way, I'd still throw Harmony Korine in there too with mm-hmm. with what he did with some of the crime elements in his film, which was low budget in Spring Breakers.
He's the outlaw with cornrows in Spring Breakers.
exactly. And, you know, the other thing, the music in this film, beautiful and evocative. You really relies on, for its percussion and its rhythm, it really relies on a sort of clapping, just a... Mm-hmm. And I just want to get my hands on that score, because I just thought it was really, really perfect and beautiful as well.
It added a strange, like, disorienting quality.
Exactly.
And a weird tension during certain scenes, like mm-hmm. when that clapping would come back in.
Exactly, and I can see where him and Shane Carruth might see eye to eye or might like working together. He talks about it, David Lowery talks about it in our interview coming up, that you could see, because they both seem to want to tell, they want the audience to access their stories. They're not trying to be confusing to people.
Yeah.
As tough or challenging a film as something like Upstream Color is, Shane Carruth, I really believe, wants to entertain and wants to engage the audience in the story. He wants you to get it.
I think that's why he cares about each individual scene and each image, like,
exactly.
within all of the scenes, you know.
Exactly.
He wants to make them compelling, so it's not just like a... It's not just fuckery that you're like, oh, all right, like, this is difficult and therefore it must be important.
Exactly. Yeah, there's none of that. And I could see why they line up eye to eye, the two filmmakers, because they're after something just a little different. And the beauty of it is that you can use genre tropes and characters and elements to have a shorthand so you can get at other things now, because
yeah.
we've seen these stories again and again and again. And if you take a different approach to it, that just shows how many more options there are to be told, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really refreshing. And this is another one of those movies where I'm a little worried for it, because it's small. It's only playing in one theater here in Portland. But this is one that deserves this sort of Beasts of the Southern Wild. Like, it should play in this town and other major cities.
Months.
It should. It should really play for a long time. And hopefully smaller theaters can do that. And I believe it'll be a VOD release as well. So if it's your only option is to see it, it's a shame you won't be able to see it on a big screen, but watch it. I just think I've seen it so far only on my computer screen. I was totally, you know, wrapped up in the story and mm-hmm. the visuals and the sound. You know, headphones would be a good recommendation if you watch it on your computer.
I saw it on a big screen TV.
Oh, good. Lucky bastard. Well, yeah. So again, I can't say much else except that just go see this damn Moody.
This Moody movie. Go see it.
It is Moody. That is appropriate.
Ain't them bodies Moody.
First off, I just want to start with how the film starts. I love this idea, the simplicity of the opening text. But even before that, you play around with the IFC Films logo to make it more appropriate with your setting. You have the bullet hole and the sun kind of shining through. And I love that touch. But then you use these very simple text of "this was in Texas." And can you just talk about both of those ideas to sort of give your film right away from the beginning, sort of announcing to the audience that this is going to be its own thing? I really like that aspect of it.
Well, in terms of the IFC logo, I was really glad the IFC let us do that because I really wanted to try to do something different. I love when you go see a movie and the logo has been tweaked slightly. It sort of sets the stage for what you're about to see, and it gets you in the right mindset, and it's just fun, and it was fun to make that. And then the title card that says "This was in Texas" was something else that was really important to me, not just to set the tone of the movie, but to let audiences know that it was going to take place in the past.
Yeah.
The phrasing of that, you know, using "this was in Texas," that was something that, rather than saying, like, "Texas, 1978, or having a little lower third title on the first shot that gives you the time and place, I wanted to take a slightly different approach and a more open-ended approach and let people know that this is a movie whose time has passed. This is a movie where the story has come to its end already, and we're going back to revisit it. And I think that just sets the right mood for the movie you're about to see. And the way it's phrased sort of speaks to the tone of the movie in the same way that the title does. And, of course, stating that it takes place in Texas right up front also lends a certain spirit of something to the movie. Whatever Texas means to you as an audience member, mm-hmm. that is something you're going to carry with you into the film. And certainly it means a lot to me as a filmmaker who lives and works in Texas. I wanted to make sure that was front and center.
Yeah, it was a really great touch. It's so evocative. It felt so fresh because normally I feel like most people who would look at this exact same script and wanted to do their opening titles, they would say "Once Upon a Time." You know, they'd use that, which, you know, it's very evocative itself, but it's kind of tired. And I love that you found this sort of fresh angle with it.
Yeah, it was exactly that. It was exactly trying to find a new way to say "Once Upon a Time," and that, yeah, that's exactly it.
Well, mission accomplished. Well, what about the? And then just the idea, you know, Michael Mann, I'm a big fan of him as a filmmaker, and he's not the only one that does this, but he will often drop you into the story like you do and then give you the title of the film at the end. Was that, was he an influence for that sort of thing, or is that just something, again, you're a fan of in movies?
I'm generally just a fan of that. You know, one of my favorite examples of that is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes.
The title comes in 20 minutes into the movie.
Yes.
Shows up, it recalibrates you, and mm-hmm. you have to decide as a storyteller where you want that recalibration to happen. Sometimes you just get it right out the way at the front of the movie, and that sets the stage for the movie, but this film, it didn't feel like it needed that. And we actually had an edit of the movie the one we showed at Sundance had the title occurring about 10 minutes in, and even that didn't feel quite right. It felt like, you know, it felt like it was getting in the way. And so we decided to take it out and save it for the end of the movie so that you could really have a little bit of time to think about it as the credits were rolling and think of the way in which it applied to the film. I love Michael Mann. I think Heat is one of my favorite movies. Last of the Mohicans was a tremendous influence on this movie, believe it or not. That's one of my very favorite action-adventure period romances. Probably my favorite. And it's got one of the best scores of all time.
Yes.
But, I wasn't thinking about that in terms of the beginning of the movie. I just like not having to provide exposition. I like, as an audience member, I like not getting exposition. I like to be dropped in and have to sort of run to keep up and figure things out on my own. So that was just a natural storytelling device for me that I use. That's just how I like to tell stories. And I'm sure that, you know, growing up loving Michael Mann movies, that the way that he does that, which he certainly does, was, somehow that got lodged in my subconscious, but it wasn't something I was consciously thinking of.
Very cool. I mean, I love that you referenced Eternal Sunshine, because I remember my mind being kind of blown that it's like, holy cow. I mean, the title might even come in later than 20 minutes into that film, and how much that does recalibrate what you're thinking with this film. But then, have you ever heard or seen this Japanese film called Love Exposure by this guy named Sion Sono?
Oh my God, I want to see that movie so bad.
Dude, you have... Ugh.
I missed the chance to see it on the big screen a couple months ago in L.A.
That's too bad. Oh my God, they showed it in a theater in L.A.? That's amazing.
Yeah,
Yeah, well, they dropped the title in that movie. It's over 4 hours long. I think the title comes in about an hour and 15 minutes into the movie. It's pretty incredible. You have worked as an editor and kind of done every job, it looks like, on a film set. And I'm just curious as to, I want to get more into your editing, but right now, just the idea that you look like you've done a bit of everything on a set, and how that's influenced you as a filmmaker now that you're starting to direct films and stuff like that.
It's really kind of helped me figure out how I like to make movies, the context in which I like to make movies. And I've worked on lots of different sets of all different sizes, and it helps you figure out what matters to you and what you need to tell the story you want to tell. And, you know, the reason I've worn so many hats is because I've always kind of relied on myself to get my movies made. I've always been someone who, you know, I didn't go to film school. I just wanted to figure it out for myself. And the great way to do that is to work on other sets. And so I've done a little bit of everything, and I know how to do a little bit of everything. Editing is the one thing I know how to do a lot of, but I can, you know, hold a microphone. I can push a dolly. I can set up a C-stand. And knowing all that stuff, knowing the accoutrement of a film production is really helpful. It really, you know, helps you understand when you're working with a crew, you know, what they have to do, what their jobs are, how much time it's going to take. It just helps you understand and empathize with everyone else who's helping you realize your vision. And again, like I said, it helps you realize exactly what you need to tell the story. Yeah. And there's also the factor of, like, I've always just wanted to help my friends make movies, and they've helped me, and I want to help them, and if they need me to do something, I would gladly run and do it. And so that's how I've ended up holding boom mics and setting up lights and doing all the different things I've done.
Maybe I'm making too much of an assumption here, but I assume you're friends with director Shane Carruth and Amy Simons as well, because you've co-edited both their films recently, right?
Yeah, definitely. I've known Amy for many years, and I've known Shane more recently, but they're both really good friends.
I want to talk mostly about Anthem Body Saints, but I have to ask you about Upstream Color, because I think I've seen that film 5 times now. I'm very obsessed with it right now. And
oh, great.
I just recorded an hour-long podcast about it yesterday with another friend, and I couldn't stop talking about the editing. And then sure enough, you are the credited, you know, at least the co-editor on that film. And can you just talk about how that film was developed? It must have changed a little bit in the in post, but I did read an interview with you where you did say that it's not that far off from the script too. Just maybe just briefly talk about it, because I love the editing in that film.
It's not that far off from the script. Shane had a very clear idea of what he wanted, and for me as an editor, what I always like to do is to not look at the script at all. So before I'd ever even, you know, entertain the idea of working with him on the movie, I read the script and thought it was great, and then I never read it again. I never went back to it. And when he asked me to come on board and help edit the movie with him, I didn't look at the script. What I looked at was just all of the footage, and that's something that I enjoy. I enjoy figuring out what a director's intentions are based on what they've shot. And if I, in the best case scenarios, you know, I can figure that out just based on the footage. I don't even have to talk to the director. I can look at, and, you know, 4 or 5 shots they have for a scene, or in the case of Upstream Color, sometimes up to 20 or 30 shots for a scene. And you think about the fact that every one of those shots was shot for a reason, especially in the case of someone like Shane, who does everything so purposefully. And you figure out what they want, and you ascertain the meaning of all of those different shots, and you figure out how they're going to fit together. And it's like putting together a puzzle, but a very organic and a very amorphous sort of puzzle. And in the case of Upstream Color, it came together so naturally and so beautifully, and such a testament to, you know, the totality of Shane's vision, that he got all these little tiny pieces and they all fit together so perfectly and with such purpose, and that I was able to figure out that purpose without even talking to him, because he was still shooting the movie when I was editing it. I really can't think of a creative experience that was more fulfilling or more profoundly satisfying than working on Upstream Color. And it feels so complex when I go back and look at it now. I watched it again the other night, and it's almost dizzying, which is what people have been telling me. It's like, it's so complex and so, it seems so daunting. But in the moment, when we were cutting that movie, it seemed like the most beautiful and the most natural thing in the world. And it was so much fun to just start pushing in all those shots together and watching it come out as a fully formed movie.
Yeah, that must have been incredible. I mean, to me, it seems like a movie that could only really have been edited in this modern age with computers, because I don't know how you would cut film in that way. And yeah, it sounds like you agree. I mean, that just seems like you couldn't have made that movie 10 years ago.
No, and I don't think audiences could have watched that movie 10 years ago. I don't think, you know, our mental facilities were there to process information in that way. But luckily now, you know, with the way information is perceived in this day and age, you can watch a movie like that and know how to process it. And that's a really wonderful thing. I love the way, you know, storytelling evolves with our brain's ability to perceive information. And you find these artists who push their storytelling a little bit further than the way in which we process information. And that helps us take a leap forward. And that whole process is really fascinating to me.
Casey Affleck, Rooney Mara, Ben Foster, they're in this film. But the people I want to talk about is Keith Carradine, who I absolutely love. As soon as I saw him in this film, you just get a sense of, I don't know, for me, it's like a comforting feeling. I'm like, okay, I know who this guy is, and he plays a perfect sort of Western archetype. So I'd love to hear what your thoughts are working with him, but also Nate Parker as Sweetie in this film, I thought was a really interesting and sort of different take on a black character in this era, you know, 70s Texas. And there's no sort of like racism addressed or anything like that. It's just the fact that this guy existed at this time, and it felt like refreshing that he was a normal guy, that nobody really referenced his race.
I'll handle a Keith Carradine question first, which is, you know, it was a true joy to work with Keith. You know, I've admired him for so long, especially as a Robert Altman fan, it's impossible not to.
Yeah.
And when he said yes to doing this movie, I knew that character was going to come to life in such a wonderful way. And what he brought to the set was just this, you know, he has this presence that is, like you said, he can play an archetype so well, and he can turn that archetype into a human being. And that is, you know, exactly what I wanted to do with every character in this movie. I wanted to start with an archetype and distill them down to their human essence without losing that sense of them being an archetype. And he just is, he's perfect for that, because not only is he a phenomenal actor, not only is he just a wonderful actor and a wonderful human being, but he has the weight of history behind him, because he's been doing this for so long, and he's appeared in movies that are so revered and so classic, and he's played these roles that have gone down in history, and he brings all of that with him, and that creates this wonderful, almost meta-narrative for that character that I love. I love it when you have an older actor who can bring with them all of the roles they've played in the past, and that speaks, you know, that the movie is participating in that history at that point, and that's just really exciting for me. I love when movies work on that level, and I think, you know, having him in this movie, first and foremost, he just gives this phenomenal performance, and he's a wonderful actor, and he has a song on the soundtrack, which I love. I love that we're able to get him on the soundtrack as well, but, you know, having the movie participate in that lineage that goes back to Nashville and the Cave of Mrs. Miller, mm-hmm. that's a wonderful bonus. And for Nate Parker, you know, that character was not written with any actor in mind or with any ethnicity in mind. And I wanted to cast an actor who was going to just do a really great job. And, you know, it's a small part, but I felt it was an important part. And I didn't want any of the characters to feel like throwaway characters. And I talked to Nate about the part, and he just understood it so thoroughly. And he was so invested in the possibility of that character. Even though he's only got a few scenes in the movie, he really did a lot of work in making sure that that guy was a fully fledged human being who had a path, who had a purpose, who had hopes and dreams. And, you know, we didn't really talk about the race element too much because it wasn't an issue. It wasn't part of the script. And the one time we did talk about it, we were just thinking, you know, this is small town Texas. It's in the 70s. It's not, you know, you're not in the deep south in the 20s. And the one, even if we were, the one thing that kind of erases any sort of racial disparity, if there is any that exists, is poverty. And these characters are all people who aren't, you know, they're not rich, they're all pretty poor, and they're all just trying to make ends meet. And that kind of just erases any sort of class lines. And that was where we left it. And beyond that, we just wanted this guy, this character, to be a really, you know, a good person, a good friend, a guy who's got his own thing going on, who's trying to do something. And so as small as that part is, you know, the degree of texture and depth with Nate. It was a wonderful, wonderful working relationship. I can't wait to make a movie with him again where he gets a little bit more screen time.
I look forward to that as well. This year, and I include Anthem, Body Saints in this list of my favorite films so far this year, the majority of them are like your film. They're independent, they're smaller, but they're all using genre as a sort of window dressing, as the sort of environment that the story is set in, and yours is no different. And the films I'm thinking of in particular are Upstream Color is one, but Mud from Jeff Nichols, Place Beyond the Pines, the Derek C. in France film, even Spring Breakers I would put there as well. And there's a lot of films. I mean, Kelly Reichardt, you've worked with Will Oldham in the past, and Kelly Reichardt is a filmmaker that I think does this as well, especially with Meek's Cutoff. So I'm just curious. Yeah, and Jim Jarmusch does this sometimes. And what are your thoughts on this sort of resurgence of genre, like using it more as the setting? Because I know you've talked about how there's the familiar elements of genre that you can use as sort of like a shorthand, and then that allows you to dig deeper into the other things that normally aren't covered in these kind of movies.
I think there's a wonderful opportunity, like you said, to sort of dig into issues or characters or themes with the trappings of genre as your context, because who doesn't want to go see a Western? Who doesn't want to go see an action movie? Who doesn't want to go see a movie about teen girls robbing stores, you know?
Yes.
There's a degree of, you know, entertainment that is implicit in that, and that's what you use to as your entry point into whatever it is you're looking to explore. And the wonderful thing about genre is that you can do anything with it. You can take a space opera and tell an incredibly personal story about loss, like what Solaris was, the Tarkovsky movie. You can take Mud, for example, and tell a really rousing, old-fashioned 1980s action movie, and also have to deal with really strong issues of growing up in the South.
I just want to know real quick, are you still writing the script for Pete's Dragon? Is that happening?
Yeah, I've got a story call with the producers this afternoon.
That's awesome.
We're in our second draft of that, and it's coming along very well, and it's really fun to write a Disney movie, I have to admit.
That's great, man. Well, I look forward to that. I look forward to whatever you do next. And thank you so much, David. You've been really generous with your time. And I feel like we could have talked for another half an hour about movies. And just good luck with the film, man. I can't wait to see it again.
Thank you so much. It means a lot.
All right. So lastly, I guess we're just going to do a sort of speed round through just things we want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, this is already dead news because after people shit all over Ben Affleck's chest, they moved on to Miley Cyrus's tongue and are not focusing on the fact that a nuclear reactor in Japan is poisoning the rest of the planet. But who cares?
Who cares when a new Batman's being cast?
To backpedal, let's get back to last week's news of Ben Affleck being cast as Batman.
In the sequel for Man of Steel.
Yeah, so it's going to involve Batman.
He'll be established already as Batman, we assume, and obviously this is going to be a whole new take than the Christopher Nolan Batman, which is what they've always said from the beginning, and I'm glad that that is actually coming to fruition.
And what the internet is really good at is like flaring up with a lot of histrionics and then someone countering it by saying, well, this has always been the case. So like everybody loses their minds about Ben Affleck and his square jaw getting cast as Bruce Wayne and Batman. And then someone counters by saying, well, you know what? Everybody lost their mind when Michael Keaton was cast as Bruce Wayne and Batman because he was Mr. Mom and Beetlejuice. And he was, I mean, I honestly feel like he rivals, I don't know, like let's dig into it.
Let's dig into it. Let's do it.
Because I feel like people argue that Michael Keaton is the best Batman. Mm-hmm. Christian Bale, it was a great choice for the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight series. But like I feel like what people really take away from that series is the Joker performance in the second one.
Sure.
The first one is good.
Yeah.
Second one is great. Third one is good again.
It's good. It's good.
It's fine.
Yes.
But like the humanity and like just the volatile strangeness of Heath Ledger in the second one is kind of what is the takeaway from the entire trilogy.
Yes.
And so like, is Christian Bale a great Batman? He's good.
I think he's a good Batman. I think he's a fantastic Bruce Wayne. Yes. I think he's clearly the best Bruce Wayne that's been cast so far, because That's what I thought when I heard he was going to be cast, because he was kind of coming off of American Psycho and things like that.
The Machinist.
Like, The Machinist. And these are perfect, especially Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. Like, yeah. That guy can be translated a little less crazy,
yeah,
but still off, and make him a rich guy like that. And
it's an edgy choice.
Exactly, exactly.
When this isn't as much of an edgy choice.
I'm confused as to why they need a Ben Affleck for this. They either Warner Brothers knows something, or director Zack Snyder and the screenwriter David Goyer, they're onto something. They've got something we're not sure of that Ben Affleck is capable of bringing to Batman. But I'm confused as to why they need it. Henry Cavill was cast as Superman, relatively unknown. Nobody really knew who that guy was. And he did a fine job.
He
was in The Mortals, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not a great not a great example of what he's capable of. But they cast him, and it's already, Man of Steel is officially a pretty big hit, you know?
Right.
The sequel's going to almost undoubtedly be bigger. So why do you need Ben Affleck? I don't really know I actually think Ben Affleck could be a detriment to people going to see this movie. Because I don't know why they need a super famous face in that role. Maybe it's that they want to have, because Batman's going to come in already fully formed and almost middle-aged, which is rare for a Batman movie to do that. They've usually started with him pretty young.
He's going to have a fuller face.
He is going to have a fuller face. I mean, Affleck has the jaw. He could be a great Batman, and I guess we'll see what he does with his Batman voice. I think that's another thing a lot of people are going to wonder about.
He's got more of a Superman face, though.
That's the thing, right?
He's got that square jaw kind of... he would be a good Punisher, I think.
Well, he wasn't a very good Daredevil, I can tell you that. So. Yeah. But it's just, it is confusing as to, like, I'm dying to know what their reasoning is. I'm almost more curious about that than just how good the film's going to be, because I have hope that there could be such a better sequel than what we got from Man of Steel. As much as I've defended that movie, I think the potential for a great sequel is there.
You're less defensive about it now, though, right?
My wall of defense is crumbling every week, and I can't cite it as... I mean, I think on
it's
that
like a
podcast,
wall of Metropolis now. It's smashed.
It's been decimated. Yeah, close to decimated. There are still a lot of things I thought were cool about Man of Steel, but can I argue it as a good movie? I just can't anymore.
I'm glad.
I can't do that. And I do, but I do think there's potential for a great sequel. But we'll see. It seems weird. Ben Affleck as a Bruce Wayne. I wonder how often he'll even be Bruce Wayne in this one, and then whatever other movies come after.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't strike me as a Bruce Wayne. He's a blue collar Boston guy. That you could have a beer with. I feel like
he has a propensity of looking off screen when delivering a monologue. Is Batman going to do that?
Jeez, we'll find out. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I'm curious to see what they're going to do with this whole Batman Superman thing. It seems like it's all inevitably leading to the Justice League movie, which will come
in 2018.
They've got a shitload of work to do.
We're going to be super dead at that point, though. The news that we're ignoring because of the Batman and Miley Cyrus fiascos,
it's going to catch up to us. Yeah, it's going to catch up to us, exactly. So maybe we should start tuning in, because we don't know what the hell's going to happen. Internet, just calm down. Relax.
Yeah.
There's more important things.
Okay, so let's just real quick, let's try to fire off some options that maybe they didn't consider. So you've got like a Henry Cavill who like maybe had some cachet to his name around the studios, but when they knew Christian Bale was not signing on for any more of these post-Christopher Nolan, he's not going to be a part of it, they had to start brainstorming. So they had to just, like, throw all kinds of names out there.
Yeah.
So who do you think they could have considered?
Well, the names I heard thrown out there.
Actual
like,
names.
Yeah, Brolin, Ryan Gosling, which... Josh Brolin.
Okay.
Squarehead. I mean,
yeah, Squarehead also.
Ryan Gosling, my guess is they thought he could be the edgy, and he's famous, you know, there's that. But
he's a little too blonde.
A little too blonde also.
Val Kilmer did not prove to be very strong.
No. I just laughed as soon as I heard that, like, they wanted Gosling as a potential Batman, because I just don't think he has any interest in making movies like that, at least not at this point in his career.
Yeah.
And I think he's moving on to directing a film, so I don't think he's going to appear in anything for a while.
Hmm.
So I didn't think that was ever going to be a possibility. Another one I heard was John Hamm from Mad Men.
What the fuck?
So you say what the fuck? I think potentially interesting, because it's less confusing to me than Ben Affleck.
He would be a good Punisher.
He could be a good Punisher, yeah.
Totally looks like it.
He's got it, yeah. He's got the square jaw, the dark hair already and everything. But maybe that would have been interesting. I just... I don't know. I'm trying to think of...
I just don't imagine Bat... Like, it's not Bat Dad, and that's what John Hamm is. John Hamm is, like, somebody's dad.
But
like,
the thing they... I believe the... They're not directly adapting the sequel from Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns from the 80s, but it's... when they made this announcement at Comic-Con that Batman will be in the next Superman movie, they read a quote from that comic, and that's actually one of the few comics I've read, and I think it's just fantastic. But Superman and Batman fight in that movie. And Batman actually wins. I don't really... I don't remember how, but it's...
Does he break Superman's neck? Because that's their weakness, apparently, from Krypton.
Zod's weakness, I guess. But...
Spoiler.
But, yeah, it was... They're not directly... They're saying they're not directly adapting that, but Batman is about 70 years old in that comic. He's an old man that's coming back. That's why it's
70?
Called... 70? Yeah, he's like 60 or 70. He's
won't they get
basically,
an actual old man then?
Well, I mean, I think they're just going sort of an in-between, so it's... As a film, you have to believe that he could still be Batman, so make him 40-something. And maybe, you know, Ben Affleck's got a little salt-and-pepper hair going
some
on.
Some James Cromwell up in the mix.
Oh, James... That'll do, Superman. That'll do. But yeah, I wish I could think of other ones that would be good, and I just feel like if they would have... It seems to me like they got a little lazy.
Okay.
They wanted a star, and they got it one. Instead of... I don't know, I'm just speculating, but it didn't seem like they really went out there and were looking for a next, like, another Henry Cavill, a lesser-known actor that could have really done something interesting.
What about a Josh Hartnett? Too soft? How about an Aaron Paul? Too short?
Too short, definitely.
How about... Here's one.
Aaron Paul could be a bad guy or a civilian or something of Metropolis.
So here's somebody who knows hardship, who knows tragedy, but has since been insulated in, like, a world of luxury.
Mm.
Marshall Mathers. What if you got Eminem to play?
Oh, shit, dude. Did you know he was supposed to be in Elysium? Did we talk about that? He was supposed to be the lead. He was, I think it was Eminem was considered.
They
to
were
be
talking
the lead.
About him and then the lead guy from Die Antwoord, who has since been cast in the next one.
The next Blomkamp film. Yeah, yeah. Well, anyways, that would be interesting, but I got to say Marshall Mathers, he's a pretty short guy, too.
Is he?
Yeah, he's pretty short.
Yeah.
I've seen him live. He was tiny.
Just
especially compared to D12, like half the guys in the majority of the guys in D12 are huge.
Can I guess? Did you see the Anger Management tour?
I did. Damn it. Oh. It was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean,
sure. I saw him at the Roseland.
That'd be nice.
Eminem. Yeah, it was nice.
He's actually an amazing live performer.
He's great. Yeah.
I really enjoyed it for sure. That'd be a... I don't know. I guess what's to lose by going a little bit off the beaten path by...
What about who's essentially playing Batman right now on a TV show? What about Michael C. Hall?
God, see, that'd be interesting. He's got the jaw. Mm-hmm. He definitely would be good like a Christian Bale where he's off-putting a lot. He can be creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Dexter's winding down, I believe. It's
over.
He can
be charming.
He can be very charming. And that would be, I think right now, out of the names we've thrown out there, that would be by far the most
plausible.
Interesting. Yeah, and if that happened, I would have been like, nice, like that sounds interesting.
So up on the dry erase board, Michael C. Hall would be bumped above Slim Shady?
Just barely because he's got a little height on him, I think.
Okay.
He's got a
soundtrack
little more...
would be fucking nuts.
Oh,
if Eminem was on the...
Well, maybe Eminem's Robin.
Could be.
That's an R-rated movie that I'd like to see, actually. So I guess we'll find out. I mean, I know in the end you really just don't care because you hated Man of Steel so much, correct?
I did, I
yeah.
hated it.
And that's fine. I mean, but I feel like there had to be, it was worth at least discussing a little bit because
this is
just, to see everybody get all in a tizzy about these things is always hilarious because it's so many years. I mean, people freaked out when Heath Ledger was cast as a Joker.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
think that
was,
worked out. That was another one of those
counters. Yeah. Like, here's what people thought about Heath Ledger, guys.
Yeah.
Calm down.
Exactly. And
it's just hard not to sound like an asshole on the internet, no matter what side you take.
It brings it out of people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't have much to say about another film that's opening this Friday. It's called The Grandmaster. It's by Wong Kar-wai.
Mm-hmm.
It is his long-awaited. I think it took him 5 or 6 years to finish this film.
He's a favorite of the film center. I know that.
Yes. A lot of our coworkers, especially on the theater staff, are just massive Wong Kar-wai fans. And I would say that I am a fan. Like, I like more of his movies that I've seen than the ones that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about him as a filmmaker?
I really liked his early work in the 90s. One of the last films that was shown at the now defunct Guild Theater that was run by the Northwest Film Center was Fallen Angels, which
is probably
like my favorite of his.
I really like that one too. I like Chungking Express. I think Days of Being Wild is really good. That early stuff is really
Happy Together.
Yeah, Happy Together. I just recently watched and found it great. And there's that energy, like his movies kind of, especially that early stuff, they really like they have a pulse. There's an energy to them that's just thrilling, even though he has a certain visual style, and you'll notice his, you can pick out a Wong Kar-wai movie pretty quickly by the voiceover, the use of pop songs that have been reappropriated by Asian cultures. And then, yeah, the sort of camera effects that he uses. And yeah, he's got a recognizable style, but I think later in his career, he's kind of lost. He's lost me. He's sort of had a Terrence Malick effect on me as well, where I thought In the Mood for Love was like the masterpiece. I don't think anybody has made that. This is just a near perfect movie, I think. But then everything after 2046 and then My Blueberry Nights, his English language movie, just, I hated that movie. I hated it.
Blueberry? Is it Blueberry?
My Blueberry. I'm having trouble enunciating. I'm going to try better.
Blueberry is a whole different thing. That was the serial spinoff.
But this one, The Grandmaster, had another effect like his other kung. Well, this is a kung fu movie. It's the story. It's a biopic about Ip Man, the guy that ended up training Bruce Lee, and Tony Leung, who's basically he is the Ben Affleck. He is a major star in Hong Kong, an amazing actor. You probably, if anybody's seen any Hong Kong movies, I'm sure you've seen him in it. He's in a lot of Wong Kar-wai films. He's also in like Ang Lee's Lust Caution, stuff like that. Great actor. He plays Ip Man in this, and there are a lot of fights, which I think will please the people that like this genre, the kung fu movies. But just like Ashes of Time, an early 90s movie by Wong Kar-wai that I actually am not much of a fan of either, there comes a point where throughout the whole movie, it kept losing me. I was like, I'm paying attention. I'm watching this. But a lot of his films can wash over you in a way where you can just soak it all in and just sort of enjoy what it is.
Right.
Here, when it starts to do that, it's washing over me and I'm maybe not following the plot that well.
You disengage.
I disengage. And that's what's been happening to me with his last few films. And just like Ashes of Time as well, where I just kept every 10 or 15 minutes, I'm just like, it's like another fight. I don't really care about anything that's happening.
It didn't have the Dragon Bruce Lee story effect of like capably infusing the fight scenes into like his real life story.
It didn't. It actually, everything as beautiful as the fight scenes
are. It's a good movie.
This film visually, The Grandmaster is gorgeous, but those fights, as cool as they are, I just don't, I half the time I'm wondering like, what are they doing here?
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem right. And, he also does a classic Wong Kar-wai thing in this film where he veers off into other characters' stories, almost like, most of the time you're just like, what's happening? It happens in almost all of his movies. And in this one, it just feels, it's odd to infuse his style that way into this story because Ip Man seems like a very compelling character or a person from history. I feel like there's more than enough story to focus it on him, but he wants to do his thing where he veers off into other characters' stories. And it doesn't coalesce. And it's not that I don't like the movie or like it. I'm just sort of indifferent to it, which I thought was kind of the saddest thing about it, you know?
That is rough.
Yeah, it was too bad. And
because I love hating Man of Steel.
Exactly. You got a lot out of hating that movie. I certainly did not hate The Grandmaster. And I actually think there are people that are listening to this podcast, people that we work with at the Film Center that are going to say I'm crazy. And I want to know what they think. And I'd certainly love to know what I missed because it just didn't do anything for me.
Didn't click.
Did not click at all. So with that, let's wrap up episode 77.
So Eric is telling you that it is playing starting this weekend. Nothing more than that.
That's about it. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually going to be in theaters. One or two theaters, I think.
Just so you know.
Martin Scorsese's presenting it.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, he came out to support him and stuff, which is cool. Also of note is that anybody that wanted to see, this is a recut version by the Weinsteins. They cut about 10 minutes out of it. But
that's their thing this year.
Yeah, Harvey Scissorhands, man, he's coming back with that, and that's what his reputation is. But from what I understand, it has still a lot of the same problems of some colleagues of mine have seen the international cut, and they said it's not that different. So, and they said it still has a lot of the same issues, if you have the issues that I did as well. So with that movie is playing. It's in theaters.
Yeah. Prove them right.
Episode 77 of Adjust Your Tracking coming to an end. We want to thank director David Lowery. It's not his first film, Ain't Them Body Saints, but this is the one that's going to get him the attention he deserves and already has. And we look forward to whatever he does next. And we want to thank him for coming on the show. It was really a treat to have him interviewed.
Yeah.
And you can find all episodes of Adjust Your Tracking at newsroom.nwfilm.org. You can find us on iTunes.
Stitcher,
yep. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. I don't know how Stitcher works exactly, but go there if that's your means to listen to it. You can email us at adjustyourtracking@gmail.com.
And if you're all up on Twitter,
all up on it.
Don't get up off it. At adjustyourtrack, you can follow us and find out when episodes are dropping, news, our opinions on things.
Absolutely. And, you know, use Twitter if you want to help us out. Spread it out to friends of yours, your followers. Let them know that if you like our show, that they might like it.
Mm-hmm.
We want more followers. We want more people to follow us.
Yeah, we
want
to feel less alone in the world.
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, with that, and if you do that, we'll be very thankful, almost as thankful as we are to our studio producer, Anthony Brisson, mm-hmm. our main producer, super producer, Drew Wallner. Living out in Hawaii, he's apparently unpacking his things. He's got all of his DVDs and shit that he's ready to unpack.
I saw that pyramid.
He gives us his updates. We love that. We love that. Drew, we hope you're doing well out there. And, yeah, I don't know. I'm probably, again, forgetting. Oh, yeah, I got to thank you, Joe.
Oh, thank you, Eric.
Ain't them body saints? Scratching kind of day.
I feel like I got dared to grow a beard.
Do it.
I don't want to.
It's your moving beard.
It's my depression beard.
All you're going to be doing is moving boxes and
dude, I feel
boxes.
Like we've talked about that before. Depression. Did you grow a depression beard?
It wasn't a depression beard, but I had it in the summer like a month or two ago.
Yeah. It was just a negligence beard.
Exactly. Okay. That is much more apt. All right, I'm ready if you are.
Steven Seagal, the hard to kill coma beard. Coma beard. That's more like it.
I forgot he should never wear a beard.
He grows a beard when he's in a coma.
But he should still never grow a beard.
Good point.
Doesn't he have the power to like not grow beards even in comas?
Come on, yeah, he Steven can Seagal. Will himself to not grow a beard even when he's unconscious.
Steven. Don't do it.
He uses the beard's power against it through the art of Aikido. Anyway, hello and welcome.
Now it's my shit. All right.